That's McCoy Tyner's Contemplation from his 1967 album, The Real McCoy. Tyner, of course, is on piano, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Ron Carter on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And I tell you, this is a great program. And it's a great program because we are ahead of the news. They might have wanted to surprise us yesterday when a settlement in the Michael Brown case was announced. But for us, of course, because we've been discussing this particular case for quite some time, it's just a tried and true tradition, the way they dispense of quote, justice in these kinds of cases. Almost 3 years after the shooting death of a college-bound black teenager by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, plunged the city and the nation as a whole into explosive debates and protests about excessive police force, a settlement in the case was announced yesterday. Lawyers for Leslie McSpadden and Michael Brown Sr., the parents of Michael Brown, announced that a settlement had been reached and that the wrongful death civil lawsuit against the city was now settled. That the lawsuit had named Thomas Jackson, the former police chief, Officer Darren Wilson, the officer who fired the fatal shots at Michael Brown, and one other person who had killed Michael Brown in this whole scenario. And we're supposed to be satisfied that this case is now over. But as I discussed earlier on, several months, we've been discussing this, as you know. We talked about there's nothing to celebrate here. And there's plenty to criticize, plenty to re-examine, plenty to press for a whole new approach to this case. But as far as they're concerned, meaning the officials are concerned, this case is over and done with. We need not worry about this. This is now behind us. And the popular phrase, we must now move on. I'm not ready to move on. I think we need to stay with this case for a little bit longer so that we can understand all the facets of this case, and there are many. Because from my perspective, it is just a continuing crisis in our community and in our country. And it is not simply to be dismissed by reports and settlements. Because as we learned yesterday, we had that illuminating discussion yesterday, just yesterday. That tells you how prescient we are. We are ahead of these things. We had Sidney Powell, who was an assistant United States attorney in three different judicial districts under nine United States attorneys from both political parties with us yesterday. And she talked a lot about the Justice Department and actually titled her book based on what she knows of the Justice Department. The book is titled License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. So we are psychically in tune, you see. That's a gift, and it is not to be underestimated. You get a sense that it is time for something to happen in this case and in other cases, but you get a sense that something is about to happen. So we kind of got ahead of it yesterday, and Ms. Powell revealed how she is coping on her level with this dynamic of lies in the Justice Department, how they basically make cases go away or make cases just spontaneously appear. They abuse the law to achieve specific outcomes, denying people their rights routinely, making up evidence, manufacturing evidence, making evidence disappear, making the guilty look innocent, making the innocent look guilty. All of that is part of the major components of this case, that as of yesterday, we are to refer to this case in the past tense. It's done. It's finished. It's over. And we have none other, at least this is the scenario they laid out. The parents of Michael Brown are to blame, essentially, for making this case go away, not fully completed, and with a lot of questions still hanging in the air. Okay, so let's review. Michael Brown was killed 3 years ago. So in the world of the criminal justice system, and I mean it to sound criminal justice system, in this world, this case is done. It's finished. It's over. And if we know what's good for us, we will assign it a place in our past as well. This is done. We were very aggrieved as a community and as a nation. A large portion of the nation knew of this case. Many had different views about it. And I understand that. We all don't have exactly the same experience, nor do we have the same interest. And we talked about that yesterday. To many in the United States, this case is quite cut and dried. And that is because they have no idea about the beginnings of this case, which did not start in May last year. It started literally centuries ago. And so it is understandable that many people in this racially bifurcated nation would have an entirely different point of view. It's okay by me. I mean, I expect that because I have a particular point of view because I have a particular historical reference when it comes to the judicial system. I have reason to be suspicious of it. Excuse me. I have reason to disbelieve it. I have reason, and African Americans generally have reason to look twice and three times and four times at the court system, the criminal justice system, because we have a distinct history, a distinct point of reference about it. And it is important for us to hold on to that point of reference. It's perfectly legitimate. In fact, I would even go so far as to say, you ignore that point of reference at your own peril. If you were to walk into a court of law to fight a traffic ticket, you have to have your wits about you based on that point of reference, that historical point of reference. It is not likely that you will get the same, quote, justice, unquote, as a white person in this country. And this was part of what Ms. Powell talked about yesterday. The court system is an alternate system, largely to exculpate the people who should be prosecuted and to prosecute those who should be exculpated if fairness prevailed in any trial. I've seen this over and over again. In fact, if you recall, I predicted this. This is how the case was going to go. And I said that since last year. I talked about the fact that we will see this case go through its predictable, tried and true tradition of, you know, regarding this case as unimportant, showing no particular interest and vigor about prosecuting, and doing everything possible to calm the natives. They were in a state of uproar. And not just African Americans, people who were appalled at the irregularities that were committed in this case, they took to the streets. They tried their best to convey to the system that something is wrong here. This is at a time when we had, of course, Mr. Holder, who was the U.S. Attorney General in the Department of Justice, who had to be pressed about getting involved in this case, keeping an eye on this case for all kinds of reasons, but mostly because the case was being handled with a number of irregularities going. And after Mr. Holder, we have Ms. Lynch, the soon-to-be ex-U.S. Attorney General. These are the highest level officials in the criminal justice system. For his part, Eric Holder said that the bar was too high to obtain justice, but he's going to be looking at it, he said. He's going to look at the case. I've heard this from him before. He's going to look into it, seriously look into it, giving everybody the impression that, you know what, he's a fair-minded individual. We will just trust him. He says he's going to take a special interest in this case to assure justice. Well, look what we got. Look what we got. In such an egregious situation that would have done so much to restore faith in people about justice. There was really no effort here to establish any kind of credibility in the prosecution of this case. The case concerned, as you know, Michael Brown getting ready to go to college, and on his way home, he and a buddy of his were hanging out, walking around the neighborhood, and they come into contact with the police officer, Darren Wilson, who orders them to stop, particularly Michael Brown, because by the time his companion spotted the police getting close to them, he kind of separated himself and he was on his way, which left Michael Brown by himself there for a moment. And in a short space of time, this encounter goes totally wrong. It goes down fast and really wrong. The police officer, Darren Wilson, draws his weapon. He fires several shots at Michael Brown, and he dies sprawled out in the middle of the road. Well, immediately, the community goes berserk. Many people had witnessed it, the tragic encounter. By then, Officer Wilson himself had become scarce. He didn't actually stay in the situation when he called for help. And then the case officially begins with the essential question, what happened here? Well, it was established that the fatal bullets came from Darren Wilson's gun. Then came immediately the accusation or explanation from Darren Wilson that he came upon Michael Brown in the course of conducting an investigation into a possibly attempted robbery at a neighborhood store, and he engaged or attempted to engage with Michael Brown to ask some questions. Brown became belligerent, and the situation escalated to the point where Darren Wilson said it was past the point of a casual conversation and now took on the very clear tone of law enforcement. And then we had Michael Brown responding to this tone. He is no longer just a guy walking down the street on his way home. He is being accosted by a police officer, or the police officer was attempting physically to accost him, and he responded by pushing back against him. And moving toward the direction of his house. This is when the seven bullets rang out, and Michael Brown is in the middle of the street, bleeding to death. Okay. We have seen these kinds of encounters so many times, where people lose their lives in a police encounter. The police escalate things to a point where it becomes violent, and they are the ones most often committing the violence. And very often, it is a fatal encounter. But a police officer is not to be found guilty of physical or fatal violence. So the system goes into immediate cover-up mode. And it continues and continues over several months. In fact, this happened in 2014. So for 3 years, we've had this wishy-washy, quote, investigation. A jury was impaneled only after intense pressure from the community and from Michael Brown's parents. And there's no indictment. And how unusual is that in African-American communities? Not at all unusual. It was expected. People predicted that. Not because we don't like the white officer, not because of some racial tinge to this thing, but because we've been through this many times. This is the system acting predictably to protect one of its own. Obviously, with no charges filed, then a different level of anger was expressed by the people. They demanded that a high official get involved in this case. That person was Eric Holder, who swore on everything holy that he was going to do everything to assure a fair and impartial investigation. And he promised this, and they came to him because they figured, well, look, you're the top guy in the Department of Justice. You're an African American. And perhaps you would listen to what we're trying to say, what we know where this thing went wrong. And we are seeking, they did not say, we demand that you do A, B, C, D, and E. They demanded only that he indicate a personal involvement in how this case was being adjudicated. It was that important. The faith in the Justice Department was so low. They had no reason based on history to believe absolutely that because Eric Holder was a black man, he would really try his best to deliver justice here. And justice at this point was defined as getting involved in the case, personally supervising this case, and making sure there is a fair trial. Of course, they said that in the minds of the people, there was more than enough evidence to support an indictment and then proceed with a trial, as it would go if any citizen would be subjected to that kind of experience, if you will, a legal process, in the legal process, if this had happened to anybody except a black person. They would be assured a free and impartial trial. It didn't happen. And it didn't happen by design. This is what we discussed yesterday, even before they announced a settlement. The way out for the Justice Department, the local police department, the way out is to move vigorously for this thing to go away. They can't, it's beyond the point where they could cover it up right now. So they arrange things so that they would press the complainants, that would be Michael Brown's parents principally, to look favorably on a settlement. They want this thing to go away. It isn't looking like it's going to go away anytime soon or at all. So they press, they start pressing buttons. The family by this time has lawyers, and we don't know whether the lawyers were part of this process of pressing the parents to enter into a settlement with the city. But it certainly did turn out that way. And I was highly critical of this and predicted these steps. And I hate to use the word predicted. I'm not a psychic. I'm operating strictly on the basis of how these kinds of incidents are handled by people we don't know, we're not seeing them, but they're calling the shots. And people are playing on the same team, although they're making it look like they are part of the effort to fight for justice. They're calling for marches, talking that talk about, you know, police brutality. All of this is keeping them in the floodlights as an important person, a person of great stature and credibility within the African American community. But their currency actually is directly linked to a very horrible situation. A young black man is killed by a white cop, which is itself a whole other dynamic that you could write books on. There's a lot of history there. But that we also have this matter, which is unresolved still, of whether people have rights or not, including the right to life. Do police have the right to snuff out your life and not be called upon to pay for it in a court of law, to be examined publicly, to have the process open that people can observe? Because they're interested. Well, of course, there's a great sense of loss and anger and outrage, but there also is a yearning at times like this for the law to prevail and to prevail fairly. None of this happened. And that's when this case joined the hundreds, if not thousands, of cases like it, in which you know how it's going to turn out. You know how it's going to turn out. So that from the very beginning, with that knowledge, with that history, this case, very early on, indicated a departure from the norm and a return to tried and true tradition. White cop, he obviously is right. I remember covering a case, so many years ago. It was in Brooklyn on Thanksgiving Day. There was some kind of altercation in a housing project. And apparently it made so much noise that people ran toward it to find out what was going on, as this would be the case. And one of the people who ran to find out what was going on was a 14-year-old boy named Randolph Evans. By this time, the housing project was kind of swamped with cops. And one of them, his name was Robert Torsney, Randolph Evans, went up to the police officer and asked him a simple question. What's going on? Robert Torsney removed his gun from his holster and at point blank range and without saying anything, fired a bullet into Randolph Evans's head and killed him instantly. Well, there were so many witnesses to this. It was assumed that this is one crazy racist cop. And somebody's got to see to it. The neighborhood will get involved and somehow protect the rights that Randolph Evans had, even in death. Well, they came up with the idea of a mock trial. It kind of, in other words, they held for public consumption, they held a supposed trial. And in that trial, the defense, the officer's lawyers, said that Robert Torsney, at the moment he killed Randolph Evans for no reason whatsoever, suffered a psychotic episode. They actually invented a disease. They invented some kind of strange psychological explanation. And Robert Torsney walked away free. So we've seen these kinds of things over and over and over and over again. And within a matter of minutes of Michael Brown's death, anybody rooted in that kind of history would know instantly to be suspicious and would also anticipate that nothing will happen to the cop. And on both counts, they were absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. So we have these charlatans coming into play because when these things happen, the system recognizes they need some help. Somebody's got to put a lid on this and get this matter controlled immediately. So you enter Al Sharpton and others of the sort. And their job is to pacify the people. Yes, you're outraged. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. You could do all of that, the theatrics. But underneath all of that, he's having meetings and consults with the people he should be marching against to convince them how important it is to add him to the mix. And he will do the job of keeping people quiet, keeping them in line. And of course, they would engage in some bizarre psychotic behavior because they're playing both sides. They're playing both sides. And apart from the fact that this gives them a great opportunity to be highly visible, which means money, they're now basically lifted up a notch or two, because now they have the attention of a broad constituency, especially of black folks who otherwise would have nothing to do with them. So they are now in the midst. They have the opportunity now to bring in the lawyers that they like. Again, this has to do with money. Calling marches and demonstrations and whatnot, but they're not fighting like they mean it. They're fighting like they want to look like they mean it. So that's one element. Their job is pacification. They're the rational Negroes. They're the people who can keep their cool in the midst of all of this panic. And they also can play a great role in keeping a lid on things. They will be rewarded. They will be rewarded. It was interesting that as this settlement was announced, the usual suspects were not there. You know, they would sell their children's eyeballs just to feel the warm glow of television cameras. Because this is part of how they make money. They make money by being civil rights leaders. And they're almost always playing both sides of the fence. And it always involves money, which is why when Jesse Jackson, the mentor of Al Sharpton, went to Ferguson, the people chased them out. They said, get out of here. The younger people said, get out of here. And they had to get out of Dodge because it was beginning to look a little bit edgy. That in the middle of a community suffering and so upset by this intentional treatment that they're getting from the police department and from the Justice Department. For them, the idea was to appear on the front page of the local newspaper to get some airtime on the television cameras and to become the instant spokespeople and the instant experts on what had happened, even though they were never there. And then, you're not hip to this aspect of life in the African-American community. The big competition then becomes, who is going to preach the funeral? That is absolutely a huge thing. They will fight each other tooth and nail for that, because that is guaranteed coverage. And after they preach the funeral, unquote, they go back to being the old typical preacher. A plate is passed. It would be announced. Well, as you know, the family is cash strapped, and we must do our best to see to it that our brother goes home to glory in the best way that we can. So please be generous with your gifts as the plate is passed around. And if you aren't paying attention, if there isn't somebody supervising this whole process from beginning to end, that money will be severely diminished by the time it reaches the hands of the pastor of the church. I know, I've witnessed this time and again. This is how this segment works these tragedies. But ultimately, there is no justice to be had here. But there are lots of secret meetings being held. Questions are asked about what more needs to be done. What else could you help us with? And there's always a willingness to help. It will cost them, but they will help keep order and to persuade the people that this is not one of those other types of cases. This is going to be different. There will be justice. Because, you know, Al and Jesse know Eric Holder personally. Everything along the way is going to cost somebody. They don't do anything for free. This is not because they're dedicated to justice. It is to mark up a bill, which would not be written, so there's nobody to testify that, you know, I have evidence, I have the receipt. And then they would discuss a strategy in which each person will play a part to bring about justice, unquote. Eric Holder's contribution was a report, a way to stop these kinds of fatal encounters from happening. As the country's highest level prosecutor, he's not interested in prosecuting anything. But he wants to look like he's interested in justice. But he will not go up against the Fraternal Order of Police or the local police chief or anybody in law enforcement. He is not going up against that. He's not going up against the DA who did the most outrageously bad handling of this case. He's not going to do any of that. We talked about it. You may be inclined to say, well, Trace predicted. This is not a prediction. When you've covered and you've experienced as many cases like this as I have, and most people have, you can practically write out the script of how these things are going to happen and how they will end. This should be the at least in recent years, this case should be the watershed for a definitive change in police conduct and operations. And somebody needed to go to jail. And there are a whole bunch of people who are eligible for that. The district attorney didn't just fail at getting an indictment. It was planned. Did they investigate the attorney, the local district attorney? No. The cop who did the killing blatantly violated police procedure and all kinds of other things after that, including lying under oath. Instead, he was given a very graceful exit and given a brand new opportunity to have a life. He got married. He moved on with his life, and this was just an unfortunate blip. Now I've come to the parents. They are in the hands of legal advisors. And if you ask some basic questions, well, how is this case progressing? What kind of papers have you filed here? What are you looking for? How are you going to get this man who killed the son of your clients? How are you going to get him in a jail, at trial, and then under another jail? How are you going to do that? They have no specifics. And lo and behold, we have the outcome. The outcome is settlement. Not justice. Settlement. A settlement, they would persuade their clients. Settlement is justice. Settlement is justice. That's their mission, is to persuade their clients. It's the best way to go. This way it's less stressful, you know, and you want, Michael is already dead. Just get this behind you as quickly as you can, and we will push for the highest payout possible. The same thing happened in the Garner case. I blocked it out for you. I told you what was going to happen. It's the same lawyers, the same approach. And it's not justice. Nothing in these cases suggests that they were after justice. They were after a fat settlement. Except that a settlement has a cap. Every city in which somebody has been wrongfully killed by a police officer, this idea of settlement may make you believe that's a lot of money. It isn't. There's a limit as part of their insurance policy for things like this. There's a cap. And nobody, none of the cities with this insurance will go beyond it. In the case of Michael Brown's parents and their lawsuit, first of all, it is a civil lawsuit, not a criminal lawsuit. A criminal lawsuit would have involved a rather complex trial. And Eric Holder, who could have gone that route for another trial, this one at a federal level, instead said that, you know, it's just too complicated to pursue. And the civil trial was tainted from beginning to end. But it would have had the same effect, it would have come to the same result, if Holder decided to take this case to the federal level. He was concerned whether people would see him as being partial and unfair. So for these reasons and others, because he just didn't want the hassle of it, he says, you know, he's one of those people who thought a settlement would have been a good idea. You throw some money at the starving Negroes, and even their son's death would be a distant memory. They'd be happy to get the money. In this case, it can't be more than $3 million. That is the max that the city, under the terms of its insurance policy, that's the maximum they could pay. So even on that level, they got robbed again. But there's more to come, as a fight will ensue as to who should get how much. All this time, the essential purpose of their involvement in this case was to guarantee justice. The parents are no longer fighting for justice. Michael's death helped to bring their income up considerably, even though they're being vastly underpaid. But the lawyers also are going to be happy because they too will have to be paid. They're not doing this for free. They're not doing this to as a contribution to the struggle for justice. So you see how, in so many ways, it is a matter of returning to tried and true tradition. The tradition of shilling, bamboozling people, and causing unnecessary havoc. Look, if you don't want to be bothered with the case, if it is too tough for you, say so. People are resilient. They'll find a way. But it is this orchestration of people who are not necessarily interested in dealing on the up and up. The people had been in front of this case from the very beginning. And in almost every case that I have covered, and I've covered quite a few of them, just the anticipation of money coming as a result of a settlement gets them excited. They forget that the focus should be justice, not money, not settlements. The other thing is, they're not telling anybody that the first thing that happens in a settlement, before they even get down to business to discuss settlement, the fact is, the aggrieved people, the victims, have to agree not to move in any form, in any shape, should there be a successful negotiation for a settlement. They are not to hold the city or the officer or anybody else harmless. They are to hold them harmless. They're not to charge them with any further crimes. It stops the minute the clock starts running on settlement. They cannot, by law, they cannot break that vow, that promise. They have to sign a piece of paper and pretend, essentially, that this didn't happen. They give up all rights, and in so doing, they trade the rights of the person who has been killed. Well, you're already dead. We are the ones who have to continue living. So they're willing to trade you and your death off for what will be a measly piece of cash. You may remember that last year, I talked about a case, no, this year, I talked about a case in Louisiana where 13 families agreed to such an arrangement, and they gave them in settlement $13.3 million for the loved ones that the police killed during the floods and during the hurricane, when lawlessness was the order of the day. And they were killed by police. One death was just so heinous. The police killed this man and then drag his body and stash it in the back seat of a car and then burned the body so as to avoid any identification. That family, too, also agreed to a settlement. You see? So we should talk about these things some more. We're on to them. We're on to these methods of avoiding responsibility and accountability for things that would get any black person, any Latino, any ordinary person into some really deep and permanent trouble. And this is what needs to be tackled out in the open. Out in the open. The time has come to reorganize our way of thinking and operating when it comes to these kinds of heinous crimes. Well, my time is running out, but certainly we're welcome to continue the conversation tomorrow or after that, because this is very, very important. So important that before any formal announcement, we're onto this. We know this. This is no news. This is a serious reminder of our duty to fix it, because no matter which way you turn, it's somebody operating under the radar for their own reasons. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me on email at leadstories@gmail.com. I want you to think about this, because this is going to be an ongoing problem. And it seems that we will be the ones having to fix it. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.